The following podcast was recorded before Russia invaded Ukraine on Thursday, February 24th. The discussion that takes place between David and me is still relevant related to kidney policy. However, the discussion does not consider how the invasion of Ukraine will affect the United States in general and kidney policy in particular. So David, since we recently enjoyed the Super Bowl, I thought what we would do is organize today's discussion in four quarters. How does that sound?
That sounds fine.
So we'll start with the first quarter and the United States Preventative Services Task Force. So there's some exciting news on this front. I'm wondering if you can just tell us why the USPSTF, which is a tough acronym to say, why that entity is so important, and then we can talk through the and then we can discuss the important news.
Okay, sure. The United States Preventative Services Task Force is a quasi-independent, I guess you would say they were independent, office that basically, what it does is it evaluates conditions in healthcare and medicine, and then it makes determinations about what type of screening would be appropriate for those conditions. And that's a pretty big, important thing for a lot of the things that we want to achieve. Because back in 2012, 10 years ago this summer, the USPSTF did a review and decided that there was not enough evidence and action to be taken and just the overall impact to have preventative screening on kidney disease. And I think when they were talking about chronic kidney disease, they were really just, I think they kind of got sidetracked and got to the idea of like didn't make sense to screen the entire country, which is not what I think most people in nephrology were really thought was appropriate. There are some guidelines and there's some ways in which you could look at it for what would be appropriate for individuals who should be screened for kidney disease by primary care. And so we ASN, along with NKF and the Coalition for Kidney Health, have been working since December of 20, well, since for a while now, but very specifically since a particular request that we put in 2020 that really asked them to revisit this issue. ASN also, along with NKF and the others, had been doing work on Capitol Hill to get members of Congress to also weigh in with USPSTF to ask them to consider revisiting this issue as well. And this week we received news that they are indeed this year going to review that. That's not a guarantee that anything will happen, but it's a big step that they had not been willing to do for quite some time. And I mean, everything that we want to do, that everybody who is an ASN member that listens to this, you know, or even non-members, that he cares about kidney, you know, we all want to get upstream. We want to get up there. We want to slow people down before they end up with kidney failure. We want to make sure that it's equitable for everybody, and that, you know, we can prepare those for transplant who need transplant, and those who might go to do home dialysis can get prepared. So there's a lot of things to do. Plus, there's new medications. You know, we've talked about a lot of the new therapies that are out there, like the SGLT2 inhibitors, as one that can make a difference now in the progression of kidney disease. So I think our efforts to point out to them that things have changed a lot in 10 years and it's time to revisit the issue seem to have, it's going to make it an interesting first quarter here, as you're saying.
Yeah, and I guess the other point, in addition to everything you said, is because of the recommendations last fall from ASN and NKF to remove race from the estimation of kidney function, by all accounts, that's going to increase the number of people who are likely, when screened, to then need follow-up either with a primary care physician or a nephrologist related to their kidney function. Just seems like the timing of this, when you put all these pieces together, seems ideal for having a, you know, revisiting the decision and hopefully resulting in screening for particularly people at risk for kidney diseases.
Oh, I totally agree with you, Todd. I think it's really important that if we're going to address equity, this is one of the places that we really have to start. And we're going to have to be, you know, vigilant to make sure that this is equitably applied across the healthcare system to be able to make sure that, I mean, screening in and of itself isn't any good by guideline standard if it's not equitably available and actually used for everyone who might be an actual candidate for some of the therapies that could change where their disease state may go.
So just to pull this out a little bit in terms of the sort of global picture here, I do think there's also, just to let everyone know, there's also an effort, the International Society of Nephrology, the European Renal Association, and ASN are working together to try to raise awareness of kidney disease at the level of the World Health Organization. So we're collaborating in the hopes of adding kidney diseases to the WHO's list of non-communicable diseases. It's astounding that it's not there. But I do think things like the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force decision on screening does influence what gets included on that agenda. I recognize they're separate, but I do think there's a bigger picture here that it's really important for everyone to understand.
Yeah, I agree with you. I know you're probably much more involved in that particular effort than I have for the World Health Organization effort, Ben. But the truth of the matter is, healthcare systems in general and payers also look to the policies in the United States, and they kind of look to them and say, if that's the standard that's going on in the U.S. And that's long since been the case with the FDA. There are many countries out there who will provide approval for a drug or a device based on what the FDA has already done. So, it really does indicate that there's a lot of trend setting that comes out of healthcare in the United States, and that is something that does help move issues along when FDA and Medicare and things of that nature take a position.
So you mentioned the FDA. That's a perfect transition to our next topic, which is, I'm just thrilled that the Senate has confirmed Dr. Rob Califf to return as the administrator of the Food and Drug Administration. And, as an aside, Dr. Califf was instrumental in helping ASN partner with FDA back in 2012 to establish the Kidney Health Initiative, which now has more than 100 member organizations. And a lot of the work we did there was based on work he had done when he was at Duke University and in the cardiovascular arena. So just to thank him again for that assistance, but also the fact that he has been so supportive in terms of the kidney community and its interactions with FDA. He also recently stepped down as a member of the steering committee for Kidney Acts and was helpful again there in terms of framing our initial thinking and what we were doing and thinking creatively about the future of innovation in the kidney arena. So personally and I think professionally, I'm very excited that he has this new role. What do you think that means in terms of, his ascending back to being the administrator of FDA?
As you know, and I imagine a great deal of many of our listeners know, FDA has been allowed ahead for over a year now. And it's been a period with it's not been without controversy. And there's been a whole bunch of them. And so both through COVID responses and also to deal with approval of medications for Alzheimer's treatment, there's been a great deal there that's really in need of a full-time FDA commissioner that can move things along. Because as an agency, federal agencies, when they don't have their head and it's an acting basis, have a tendency to kind of go into kind of like autopilot mode. Like, let's keep everything running until we get a new head before we go off in new adventuresome ways. And so he's got lot to deal with. He's going to deal with a whole range of issues. I know that a lot of people are going to be watching to see what he does in regards to any further opioid drugs. And he was actually working on making changes within the opioid situation at that period of time when he was at FDA, but I don't think he ever had a chance to actually implement anything. And there some of the senators who did not vote for him did not vote for him because they feel like he did not move quickly enough and forcefully enough on opioids. And that's their right as senators to make that evaluation. But we're hoping for him to be able to have a strong leadership role and really move the agency along. There's a lot to be done. And by the way, Mitch Zeller is leaving as the FDA's tobacco's longtime director. And, you know, most people forget that FDA had not been allowed to regulate tobacco for a long, long time. And that didn't come till about 10 years ago. So that's another big one out there. And we're going to see how they go on that. We just recently had some confusion over what FDA was doing on the request it made to Pfizer to apply for its COVID vaccine for children under 12. And there was kind of a last minute cancellation of one of the meetings that was going to discuss that. There's a lot there that I think people want to see the new FDA commissioner really kind of take on and kind of take a command of.
Well, David, I guess, you know, as I think about it, you know, it's halftime now. We've completed the first two quarters. Why don't we shift from the two pieces of good news to perhaps two pieces of not so good news? So the first is some upheaval at the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy. So Dr. Eric Lander has stepped down. There's some controversy in terms of his relationship and sort of how he treated some of his coworkers, and he made the decision to step away. I think why that's important for our audience is that he was one of the real drivers behind the concept of ARPA-H. So can you just remind us what ARPA-H is or what the concept is, and maybe speculate now that, you know, he's no longer at OSTP and Dr. Francis Collins has stepped down at NIH, kind of what the next couple months may look like in that arena.
You know, it is true that threw a monkey wrench in things at the White House, definitely. ARPA-H is designed to be the healthcare equivalent of what DARPA is, and that is a agency within the Department of Defense that gets funded to, I don't know, Todd, you can maybe explain it better than me. I mean, it's always been, DARPA's always been the kind of the funny thing in the room, you know, when you get to budget stuff on Capitol Hill, because you can't see the budget for them, really. I mean, you can see an outside figure, but they're kind of allowed to really research and do a lot of work on things that that probably, you know, they want to keep secret for reasons of national defense. But they've been credited with having done many, many things, including having basically given us the internet. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting history because it grew out of the U.S.'s reaction and the Eisenhower administration's reaction to Sputnik. So when the Soviet Union launched Sputnik, there was the real panic. And, you know, you hear people throw around the term, you know, we need a moonshot. And, you know, of course, the cancer moonshot has been something that the Biden administration, and actually when the current president was vice president, it was something he was interested in. And so that was kind of the thought, was how do we marshal both funding, but also a different sort of approach where there's less bureaucracy, if you will, around the administration of research funding, and then to target very specific issues. You know, first the sort of what turned into the NASA program or the Apollo program, ultimately in terms of putting, you know, people on the moon. Interestingly, the Moderna COVID-19 vaccine was a result of some DARPA funding. GPS is probably the example most people use, and so, you know, there's a lot that's happened there. And then the question becomes, should we have something similar for health and that's targeted specifically at health? And if so, where do we house it? And I think that's where things started to get really interesting with the administration, in terms of they wanted to house it within the NIH, which is very different than how DARPA is structured, because then it would be sort of constrained by, you know, NIH's approach to these issues, which is, you know, interesting to sort of play through. So,
yeah, no, I was going to say, I have a tendency to be a little bit, not speaking for ASN, but just personally, a little bit, you know, devil's advocate, and say, give them as much leeway as you can. But, you know, we all love the work that NIH does, and that's not a reflection on them. But, the little dust up that happened on Capitol Hill recently about where it goes, I don't see that as anything more than just kind of a little bit of back and forth between lawmakers along the way. Do you see it as, I don't see it as anything terribly detrimental to the future of ARPA-H.
Yeah, you know, I could see it both ways. I mean, I spent about 10 years lobbying for specifically NIH research and happened to be as part of the team both that advocated for the establishment of the K Awards as well as the doubling of the NIH budget. And I think the thing that concerns me, given that history, is that if you create something and you as large as ARPA-H, you put it within NIH, then you essentially, you know, double the NIH budget again. And by doing that, it becomes a very political target. And I think, you know, if we go back and sort of look at the post-doubling of the NIH budget over the last 20 years, it's hard to say that NIH hasn't become more politicized, not that it always hasn't been. So I think that's one challenge. I think the second is then it becomes even a larger target, you know, because it is part of the appropriations process. And as you think about, you know, balancing the budget or at least thinking about any sort of budget constraints and maybe future sequestration, et cetera, I think you have a real challenge because you can't, you know, start to do much if you've got something that large. So I think that's the other concern. So again, I'm not opposed to it. And I think you're right. It's mostly legal maneuvering, but I do think it raises some of these very strategic questions about the the politics of the medical research enterprise. You know, the final point I would make is that while NIH is the largest and has been the most important of the federal research efforts, I mean, there is a lot of other research funding in PCORI, Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, the Department of Veterans Affairs, et cetera. And, you know, I think we probably need to have a conversation around, you know, is there a way to better align all of those assets to maximize, you know, investment, especially from our perspective for kidney diseases?
Absolutely. I absolutely. And I do understand your point about it wouldn't take long before appropriators, let's say, in a mode to find some extra dollars when there's not a whole lot of extra dollars in the budget, to very quickly forget that the reason why that budget had become so large was because ARPA-H was housed there. And I think it would be inevitable that would start to become a part of the conversation about funding NIH. So I think we're moving forward there. But we're not out of COVID yet, by the way. And that money issue has come back up just recently.
Yeah, so I think that's a perfect sort of fourth quarter for us. So what is likely to happen in terms of both the administration's response to the COVID-19 pandemic, as well as, you know, what this means from a funding perspective?
Sure. I mean, as you know, Secretary Becerra at HHS recently signaled that, and it was interesting that they actually had him do the original announcement first and not have the White House do it first. And that was the request that they made to lawmakers for an additional $30 billion, billion with a B, for COVID efforts. And that would be across all kinds of things that we have seen during this whole pandemic. So, you know, that's a big price tag. And it's just, you know, it's an election year. And let's face it, whether we think it's good or not, COVID has become a part of the political debate. And everything involved with that, from mask mandates to vaccinations to anything you can think of, it's kind of getting tied up in that. So I would expect to see some of those individuals on Capitol Hill who really have not liked the more stringent part of government in response to COVID really take pot shots at that $30 billion. And I would imagine that it will become a very political ask as we go through the months ahead.
Well, and I would add, in addition to all the politics around the response to the pandemic, I think there's a secondary issue, which is, you know, the midterms are really going to be a referendum on the Biden administration's response, not just to the pandemic, but to inflation and to the economy. And it's hard to imagine moderate Democrats supporting additional government funding at this level. You know, even if the Fed steps in and starts to raise interest rates, you know, by all projections, it doesn't look like inflation is going to go down dramatically enough to make a difference in terms of the elections. And so I do think that's the other sort of element here.
Yeah. I mean, you and I have been in Washington long enough to know that this country is completely addicted to cheap gasoline. And if you really want to see, when it's already a time of great division as there is politically within our country, you know, as I saw yesterday, that there's a fair amount of parts of California have passed $6 a gallon, and that's not really expected. This is not really expected to reverse itself for another 8 to 12 months. And the supply chain for everything, as our listeners know, has really been constricted, including in healthcare. So it's a very sour mood out in the country. So you really are going to probably see, I think you can put money on it, you're probably going to see the House of Representatives switch over to the Republican control. And it's going to be really hard to hope for the Democrats to hold on to the Senate, but we shall see how that works. When you're that close to that battle, then there's nothing that like a $30 billion request. That's just going to become incredibly political.
Yeah, I think you're right, and I will say on the more positive side, from the administration's perspective, you know, the president's approval rating did creep up a little bit, and there is a possibility that if things, you know, if I were to rank kind of the top three influencers for the midterm elections, I think where we are with the pandemic in the fall is number one. And if it feels in the United States like, you know, life is back to normal, quote unquote, I think that's going to be huge for a whole set of reasons. I think
number two,
obviously, is the economy and, you know, where we are with inflation and with the supply chain and sort of with those elements. And then I think the third one, which is probably the hardest to kind of get our arms around, is just the overall sense of confidence going into 2023. And if people feel optimistic in any way and feel like, you know, there's been this period from March of 2020 through kind of the fall of 2022, and they're now thinking that we're going to go back to something that looks more like 2019. I think that may tilt things toward the administration and toward the Democrats. But, you know, this could easily go the other way, too. So, and it's probably going to vary to some extent by state. So, I mean, that's sort of my quick assessment. I'll give you the last word.
So let's leave it pretty easily. It's called jobs reports and vacations. So what to look for in the next 6 months, or do job reports continue to grow as really wildly as they have in just recently, and really encouraged a lot of people who watch the economy. And secondly, it's going to be a matter of, can people afford to go on vacation? Can they afford the gasoline? And for those who want to go to Europe or someplace else, are they going to be able to? And that's going to make a big, big difference as to whether people feel like we're going in a better direction than we've been in since this all started. And so look for vacations, look for job reports.
Well, David, as always, thank you.
Thank you.